pre-service and in-service teachers and teacher educators about research and practice. For episode 11, I'm joined by two pre-service teachers, two in-service teachers, five university teacher educators, and two of the authors to discuss Tong Quarmby and colleagues' 2021 paper, Developing Evidence-Informed Principles for Trauma-Aware Pedagogies in Physical Education, from Physical Education and Sport Pedagogy. We'll begin with an around-the-table discussion. Over to you, Dan.
All right, so honestly, the biggest thing I took away from it is do no harm. When experiencing students with trauma, we must not add to their trauma. We do no harm, and we should be a rock for their storm of life. Like, be the rock where they can hold on to, and be open-minded to any and all traumas, because there's a lot of them out there. So honestly, the biggest takeaway for me was do no harm, and how can I promote love into every single student that comes across my path? And don't add any more trauma into their lives. Just, you know, do no harm and add love. I wrote some stuff down. I guess I'll read this. So number one, confidence. Students know when you're confident, and students know when you're not confident. I experienced that in school. I had a few teachers that weren't very confident, and the whole class just kind of overrode the teacher and took over. And I had a few coaches that were super confident, and automatically first day of practice was respect. We understood that the coach was super confident in his abilities, and the students all of a sudden respected him. So that was a huge thing as well. Be confident in what you do and be confident in what you say, because students can tell false and students can tell the truth. So do no harm, be confident, and let love guide you is my biggest philosophy.
I guess I'll just jump in and validate that a lot of what he said is true. And while reading through your blog post of the article, which I now have it on my list to read, hopefully I can get to that this year. There's a lot of truth in that, with the love aspect, with the care and being the rock. And I think from my experiences working in schools that have very high rates of trauma, specifically just for context, I teach in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I've taught high school, now I teach K-8. Time. That's the only thing I haven't seen on like any description is time. And even though everything there is true, sometimes when you have an environment where so many kids have trauma, including the adults, there's a longevity to it that you have to last a certain period of time for them to actually develop that trust, to develop those relationships, to develop the connections, and make students feel safe that they can kind of be themselves. Because the reality is it's unstable. And I noticed that was like a comment in there. That's a standard thing, that the environments are usually very unstable. The same thing with the schools. The schools are unstable. So like being that rock takes time. So even though you may be confident and you may have the skills and the ability to do it, that trust takes so long to build. And there was a lot of affirmations in what I've done over the years reading this article. So that's been very kind of a good feeling to have. Just doing like little things amount to big growths that you would never think of. Something as simple as standing at the metal detector in the mornings and just passing out little pick-me-up affirmations like, you know, you got this today, have a good day, just the little thing.
Yeah, so when I was reading this, I immediately thought, sort of, what a great time to read this. So us coming back, like we get our pupils back face to face next week in the UK, and they've not been in school for two and a half months now. I'm in sort of like meetings with Navin recently, like this is like trauma is something that quite possibly a lot of our pupils have been facing over the last 2.5 months at home, and not being able to get out, see friends, anything like that, and they're just in that home environment. So what a great time to read it and refresh those messages. And I also thought the five key things, like that there are things that we should be doing anywhere for all pupils, which is what struck me, like that there should be a given anywhere. But me, in terms of the C that you speak about in the blog, Ash, I think what I'm going to take into next week are the routines and structure. This is what we've been talking about in meetings for the last few days, like the importance of that, which is going to be, those are going to be really important for pupils, we think, over the next few weeks. So that was good to read, as well as the positive relationships and just getting that real positive vibe around school, where when pupils are probably going to be coming in apprehensive about all sorts of things.
Yeah, I really agree with all three guys there, Dan, Steve and Cameron, all really good points. I think when you read something like this, a paper like this, and then you compare it to, say, things that we've discussed previously on the, you know, on here, and you say, like, compare it to, like, Legoing, you know, Legoing PE or parsing PE, and you chunk it down, and then you compare it to a subject like this, it really brings home, like, the awesome responsibility of being a teacher. You know, you would hope realistically that all of us as teachers would have this as an innate feeling when you go in, not just not to cause harm, but you want it to be a really good experience for children to be around you. And, you know, you think that we automatically assume from our own lucky standpoints that, you know, everybody comes as naturally happy people. You know, we sometimes, it's really easy to forget that some people come from troubled backgrounds, difficult home lives, that don't get exposed to the things that perhaps most of us do. And I think, like, for me, taking out of that, do no harm was the big one. But it reminded me, there's a guy in England called Neville Southall. He used to be a goalkeeper for Everton in the 80s and 90s, a really good guy. And he's gone into working in care for children with troubled backgrounds, for want of a better term of describing it. Excuse me if I've got that wrong. Anyway, he's become really quite famous on Twitter because he is now known for, if we all recognize Twitter, but we don't use it for PE, if you turn on to nearly any other subject, it's a lot of people in a room who seem to be quite upset shouting at each other all the time. And he's become quite famous for asking questions, you know, so like asking, does anybody know anything about, you know, transgender children in care homes? Because I don't really know what I'm talking about. So somebody please explain it to me. And I think that when we go to the T, the A and the C, the thing that I'm going to change is be asking more questions rather than trying to find, you know, from other professionals.
Okay, please be nice to me because it's my first time joining in. But I think obviously from kind of reading the paper, I think what really jumped out at me was recognising that kind of really diverse role as teachers. And I think thinking back to obviously my own time as a teacher, you obviously recognise and certainly hope that you have an impact beyond that time you're in the classroom with the people. But I think really highlighting that kind of diverse role and actually perhaps kind of thinking alongside one of, I think it was Tony Rossi's papers, about our role in interacting with different agencies to try and support pupils in that was really interesting. But I guess more than that as well, kind of highlighting actually this is, you know, more and more pupils will be experiencing trauma in different ways. And actually I wonder how sometimes aware we are of the children in our classes who might have experienced that trauma. And again, kind of reflecting on my own time in a classroom, I wonder how much I really knew about what was going on in some of my young people's lives.
Yeah, in order not to be repetitive, because I think there's so many good points already said, you know, one of the things that stuck out to me was this idea that it's a person's response to these situations that makes them traumatic or not. And that was really key. And should we be teaching resiliency? Should we be working on understanding? And I think, you know, Rachel and Ollie, great, great paper. You know, you talked about Richard Tinning's work of saying like, hey, PE can't fix all of society's problems, but should we be using our time in PE to teach resiliency, teach them how to overcome these situations that are happening either way? But we have, you know, we're not going home with them, right? We're not spending the weekend with them, so we don't have control 24/7. And you know, the two other things that I saw in those five different points is so much overlap with Nell Nodding's ethic of care that I didn't see in the paper that was referenced, but and PYD through sport, this like positive youth development through sport model that talks about these strengths-based approaches. And, you know, Ash, you, not, you noted stuff about the activist approaches in there as well. So I feel like this paper really brought together a lot of things that are happening individually, maybe in different areas. And it's great to hear, you know, people like Steve, the stuff that you do actually in classes that you're getting reaffirmed through through research like this, that it is working.
I'd like to add in there just to build on your point, Risto, with, I mean, I absolutely love this paper and I think I first heard about it in the summer. So it was a long wait for it to come out because it's something that I am really, really interested in generally. And what my take home, I think, was definitely the idea of mapping the four R's. So the realization and the understanding impact, recognizing trauma, responding. So we've got trained practices. So we're not just trauma aware, we're actually trauma, we're trauma aware, then we're trauma informed. So we know we've got a better idea of what we're dealing with, but then also we are trauma responsive. And that's the key thing, that it's all right to be aware, but we've actually got to know how to act on it and what we can do to really support these children. And I think that tipped into, building on sort of Dan's points about love, is it bell hooks that talks about pedagogies of love and relational pedagogies, which is Bloom's work, I think, with pedagogy, you know, sort of with trauma happens in a social context and it also heals in a social context. So as teachers, you know, we become PE teachers because we decide, you know, we think we love sport, we love working with children, and you know, we love that that we think that we've got great interpersonal skills. But I wonder how much that those interpersonal skills are enough, that we've got to go even, you know, we've got to go further than that and make sure that, you know, those children are so valued within the classroom, and that whatever happens, and they talk about, you know, there's other people that have been talking about being the rock, you know, that they are loved regardless of their behavior. So whatever happens, you are steady, so they can borrow our stability in order to feel stable themselves, you know, when they can't cope. And I wonder whether school is actually quite a traumatic environment in itself. So if you're already traumatized, by the time they've had multiple transitions through schools, and one teacher may have shouted at them in one class, they go to another class, something else happens. By the time they've come to us, they're already sort of, they've got high levels of anxiety. Then you've got to deal with the changing room. So there are all of these, there's so much with it, like with PE, that PE can have a real positive impact. But if our pedagogical practices and how we interact with our children and how we, what am I saying? So, you know, even down to the activities that we teach, are they trauma responsive? You know, are there some activities that lend themselves better than others? Even down to how the children have to interact with each other and how much is too much. You know, and I guess that's on an individual level, but also knowing that some kids will just withdraw and pull away completely, and how, you know, how we can deal with them. And I just think that school, as much as it can be a very, in itself, it can be a traumatic environment, it can be a really great place for healing if we get it right. And that's where, like, the five principles, they're in the teaching standards. They're wonderful. You know, they're there. That's what we do as teachers. You know, that's the expectation. But to then map it, sorry, bringing it back, but mapping it onto those four R's, I felt that was, you know, coming back to that as my final point, is that that was a bit that was important, because it's being informed in that way means that we can then be responsive to the children around us.
That's a tough act to follow, Michelle. And Michelle's points, certainly the same things that resonated with me. First off, I'd like to congratulate the authors. I'm honored to be on this episode with all of you. And I found, you know, after I read the blog by Ash first, and then I went ahead and tackled the article, and I'm glad I did it in that order. And I really enjoyed the fact that the authors asked the bigger questions as well. You know, I was torn. I went in different directions when I started reading this art, the blog and the article, which are schools equipped to handle these issues? They were never developed. Schools, at least in, you know, in the U.S., the history of public education, it was never developed to resolve some of these issues, but yet they face us now. And then the better question, how can PE respond? And I think that gets back to what Dr. Kirk has written about recently. This is precarity. This is exactly what we're talking about. This is precarity. Michelle mentioned the gaze of changing in physical education, but perhaps physical education is notably always promoting a gaze that we have to think about, putting students on display and thinking about those influences. I like the fact that the authors discussed how these trauma-aware pedagogies do mirror other examples of effective pedagogies. And I think of my son, who plays the sport of ice hockey and lacrosse, and he wears glasses and he has sports glasses. And we also made sure those sports glasses were that had the tinting, so that when they're outside in the sun, they can tint. So to help offset the rays of the sun. But on top of that, when they're indoors in the ice, and they don't fog up. And so same idea with this trauma-aware pedagogies. They mirror similar approaches that we should take when we think about inclusiveness, or when we think about being reflective, or pedagogies of effect. That's important. Meaningful physical education, which we've talked about previously. We have gone down the road of do no harm, because we can understand that meaningful PE can mean positive, but it can also mean negative. So we have to be careful with that. There's a popular saying, it's certainly not mine here in the US, but it's Maslow before Bloom. And I think this applies in this example. And again, kudos to the author. And I really want to reiterate what Michelle mentioned. That was my major takeaway from, again, our authors, that trauma can occur in a social context, but it can also be healed in a social context. That was the major takeaway I took as well alongside of Michelle, but I think it relates to what some of our other podcast guests have alluded to, a pedagogy of love. Barry mentioned an awesome power that we have in physical education. This is truly awesome if we go down this road.
The main thing that I took away from the paper is that we don't really know the children that we teach. And actually, if we want to provide a really good experience for them, we need to learn to know them and get to know them. When we're talking about developing expertise in PE, we talk about subject knowledge, we talk about subject pedagogy, we talk about assessment, but we don't really talk about how do we get to know the children in more than just the PE, so we can make better choices about the knowledge and the pedagogy and the assessments that we do. And I'm probably making some assumptions here, that the trauma-aware pedagogies, I actually probably can see them as trauma-preventing pedagogies, that we're not, if we apply them well enough, we're not going to cause any more trauma in PE. And by doing that, taking on Steve's point earlier, that gives us time to get to know the children better, to get to know who they are, so we can then continue to make better decisions with the subject knowledge, with our pedagogies, with our assessment. That was my main takeaway from the paper.
Okay, so Ali and Rachel, you've got a little bit to talk back to. I'll leave it to you for now.
Thank you. I've got lots of notes written down. I've got completely lost already. So thank you for all of those comments. That's been it's nice to hear what other people obviously think about your work. And we've had a good number of conversations. And it's really
nice in a way that a lot of the conversations, the questions that you've asked, we asked of each other. And so I think there are a few things that I'll kind of pull out, and then I'll let Ollie chip in with his thoughts as well. For me, one of the biggest things that sits underneath a lot of what we talked about was this idea of relationship. And I think, you know, a few people have mentioned that idea of the need to recognize that social aspect of what we do and the relationships, and that idea of belonging in relation to that as well. And not just to kind of know a pupil's name, but to kind of have a sense that there is more of a connection there. And I think that idea of sort of relationship and belonging really need to sort of sit alongside each other. And we had a good number of discussions about, actually, is that a separate principle, or does that effectively, should it underpin all of the principles? But I think that's a really important thing to pull out. And that's the question that Estelle asked. And I think, Alex, you just said that as well, around how well do we know our students? And to some extent, one of the questions that we've found in our research that fed into this was, a lot of the time, teachers aren't able to know their students. You know, the safeguarding, the safety, the kind of gatekeeping element means that it's only those who need to know who know. And if, as a teacher, you're not a designated teacher or a tutor, you might not actually be seen as needing to know, and that might prevent some of that relationship, that belonging element. So that for me, I think, is really important in there. Risto, you were talking about some of those areas that perhaps weren't unpacked in the paper, and you know, we're very, very aware of those. And certainly the work around ethic of care, you know, relational pedagogy, pedagogies of effects, previous versions of the paper, and positive youth development. I wrote a nice long section on that, and it just didn't make the cut. So obviously there's a lot that isn't in there. One of the things that we found really valuable in writing this is that Shirley Gray provided a really important role as a kind of critical friend. And she really got us thinking when she said, well, okay, so where do you take this? How do you take this to teachers? Well, how do you put that into practice? And so we stripped out some of those elements, because I think that's where we go next. Those are some of the things that help us put this into practice a little bit more. But absolutely, all of those things sit within there. And we wanted to be really careful in a way to do justice to that work that already sits in the field. You know, we're not reinventing things. We're not coming up with anything that's, you know, hugely sort of different, but what we're trying to do, I guess, is to collate it. And in that respect, so I think someone mentioned the idea of working, was it Barry, perhaps, with other professionals? So in working with colleagues in Australia who are much more from that psychology background, that was really valuable as well, in the sense that we look at the kind of ways that we talk about topics and issues in different fields, often in different ways, but actually what we're talking about is quite often the same process. So that was useful too. And the final point, aware of time, that I just wanted to raise, I think, Risto, again, you mentioned this term of resilience. And resilience, I think, is a tricky word when it comes to children in care, certainly. And one of the, obviously, the work that we do is sort of voice informed, and the voices of young people in care talking about their experiences. And certainly for some of them, resilience is a hard word, because when they get told often in those sort of official meetings that, you know, you need to be resilient. And we had some talk to us and say, look, this is tokenistic. This is effectively saying, I can't do stuff for you. You've got to do it for yourself. So I think resilience is important, but I think it has to be that it's sort of resilience with care. You know, you've got to combine these topics, these concepts together. And so there is a need, I think, to build resilience, but it needs to be within that space of care and loving kind of relationships, and being able to create that sense of belonging allows some of that resilience, because you're building those skills that can help with that. But obviously the resilience, the R word, as they sometimes call it, is thrown around quite freely in terms of some of that official process. So it can be a tricky one. But some really interesting things there, and I will and could talk for ages, but I'll let Ollie step in at this point.
Thanks, Rachel. And it has been really lovely hearing all the different ways that people have, I guess, resonated with the paper. Some of them ways that we'd really want you to, others that are really interesting sort of areas maybe for us to follow up on afterwards, I guess. I think I'd like to start by following kind of point I think that Alex made around, you know, maybe we don't know the children that we teach. And it's a point that I always emphasize to my first year students on a PE module. You know, they're a select cohort that they liked PE, they engaged in PE. And I think it's the same here. You know, we're engaging in this discussion around trauma. We recognize that young people can be influenced and affected by trauma. But I think there are an awful lot of teachers that maybe don't because of those busy lives that they have, the huge roles and the requirements they have placed on them, as Clancy mentioned. So I think, as Rachel alluded to, there's some important work to be done here, trying to translate this work, make teachers aware of it, especially because, building on a point that Michelle raised around sort of that PE space, and as much as we might question whether or not schools should or are equipped to support youth who have experienced trauma, I think there's an expectation that they will right now. I think it was Cameron that mentioned, you know, it's really timely. Off the back of a global pandemic, there are going to be an awful lot of children who have been through traumatic experiences during that lockdown period. For some of them, the very act of coming back to school after all this time away may well be a traumatic experience. And I think what we tried to do in the paper was really advocate what a positive space PE can be for taking action. It can be a really reparative space, but that's if we get it right, and that's if we configure that environment right. And I think Michelle made a really good point of saying, you know, it can be reparative if we enact those sort of considered pedagogies, those trauma-aware pedagogies, but actually it can also be a really damaging space. And it can be really small acts, really innocent, well-intentioned acts. I think we give the example in the paper of, you know, a teacher patting a student on the back, well done. But for a young person who's experienced trauma, that could be one of those re-traumatizing acts that we want to avoid. So I guess it goes back to a point we had very early on in the discussion today from Dan around, you know, first do no harm, but recognizing that that's a real challenge, because I think that what we need to do first is try and support teachers to recognize just how widespread trauma can be and just how impactful it can be on young people's lives. And again, a point that Stel made, you know, trauma isn't necessarily visible. We're not all aware of it. It's something that can go unseen. So raising that awareness, I think, is going to be key to sort of trying to really enact some of these trauma-aware pedagogies. But then I guess it brings us back to that point made in the paper so clearly at the start and at the end, that, you know, this isn't anything special necessarily. This is just good pedagogy. This is just good teaching practice. But maybe an awareness of trauma and the role it can play might help us to enact that good pedagogy more consistently. And I'm going to stop myself there, Ash, before I carry on like Rachel would as well.
That was great. I mean, it's fantastic to sit and listen to everybody talk. And I'm going to open it up again. And I'd really like to invite particularly Dan, Steve, Barry and Cam, because I think their experiences as teachers are really important in this discussion. And I think we need, to me, looking at all these, I've got notes, I could go on myself for ages, but I really don't want to. I think it's just good pedagogy is a slight risk in this situation, because I think if we need to actually focus on these individuals, if we raise the bar for everybody, then they, again, there's a danger that they get, to me, that they get lost in the crowd again. So actually having, you know, being more aware of these individuals, I think is really, really important in a way that we're not just raising the bar. We can all teach better, but we need to teach these individuals better. We need to, you know, this group of people. So, you know, that's something you said, Ollie, it's something that Cam said as well. I think we can strive to get better, but we need to get better for this particular population. And I think there are other populations as well, and we should be dealing with those in better but different ways. You know, I've got so much I could say here. So Barry talked about asking more questions. I think one thing we don't do particularly well is plan the questions we're going to ask. And I think that's really important to think about the types of questions that we might ask before we get into those spaces. So they're not off the cuff. They're actually considered so that we're respecting these individuals. And I think that's a challenge in teaching as well, to think. You don't have to act immediately. You can go away and think and then go back and act in that moment. And Clancy, you talked about being under the gaze. Well, if our notions of P are performative and it's about what people do, then yes, they're always under the gaze. If it's about interactions and the way people relate to each other, that's really important. And one thing, the piece of advice I often give to young teachers and trainee teachers when they're maybe struggling with an individual in their class is go and find a teacher in a school that this individual connects with. Talk to that teacher and find out why and how they connect with that individual. Learn from them about how to work with this individual and bring that knowledge into your classroom. And I'll reiterate about that here. There will be somebody in the school who, it might be a dinner lady, it might be, it might be the groundsman, it might be, anyone who works in those sorts of spaces. But if you can talk to them and find out, then you're in a better position to go forward. So I'm going to stop there and I'm going to invite everybody, but particularly Dan, Steve, Barry and Cam to kind of talk back to the points that have been made, because I think that's really important.
Yeah. Number one for me is building that trust. Like you said, find the connection for the student. It could be the lunch lady, like you said, the groundskeeper, and find that trust and find that respect. And that is your leeway into the student's mind. My opinion, I think students are looking for a leader, a role model, somebody to mimic, like, because the trauma in their lives, they're mimicking that trauma and they're bringing it into school subconsciously, in my opinion. So if we are a confident teacher and we can respect them and trust them and they can trust us, they will start mimicking us and our positive mindsets, which is huge. And I wrote down, we should put the heel back in health and PE, like heel. Our number one thing is to heal, to teach, and so forth, so on and so forth. How can we heal? And I think healing comes from trust. When students can trust us, they can start to open up and heal with us.
I'll just follow on there if that's okay. I'm definitely going to steal that quote, borrow our stability. I think that's a really epic way of saying how you can be, like, as you talked about, like a rock, something sort of deal that children can hold on to. It's a space in their school day where, or in their school life, where they can go and feel a bit more comfortable, you know, like to go and express themselves in PE or around you, and know that it's non-judgmental sounds like the wrong way to put it, but you're creating a safe space effectively. There's so much to talk about in this subject, and I think one of the important things is for me as a trainee teacher is kind of knowing where the line is, where I can help and where that is beyond my ability to help, but that borrow the stability, that's a fantastic way. That's my takeaway from it.
Yeah, I think my take home from it was that, we come in, I think PE teachers come in because they think, you presume that you're going to be working with healthy children. And I think that maybe we need to reframe how we think about trauma. Trauma becomes part of you, and it's not something like with the word resilience, you don't bounce back from trauma. You can't. It's there, it sits there, it stays there. And then you learn to live with it, reframe it, and make it look like something, make it manageable, if that makes sense. It's the beast that you kind of have to tame. And I wonder whether, like, is post-traumatic growth as opposed to resilience, so that actually you accept it, becomes accepted, and it's not this, you've got to make it better, because it doesn't just get better. It's something that sits with you. So I think, yeah, if we can be part of that post-traumatic growth in children, then their lives are going to be so much more enriched moving forwards.
I guess this is the part where I get to chime in. One word that was mentioned earlier, like resiliency, and that always brings to my mind of like strengths-based approaches and how you actually frame that. And from where I taught, if I'm under assumption, a majority of my kids have experienced trauma. Every day they show up is immediately showing resiliency. And it's about reframing that, you're resilient. You can do this, but then it's providing these extra kind of activities or tools to add to the tool belt. So everything that I try to do is based in giving them something to use and create like a toolbox, because most of my students do experience the trauma. And some of that also involves literally just having a space where kids can just spout off whatever's on their mind at any time. Sometimes there's no need to actually start class. There's just a moment for kids to tell you what's going on, talk about day-to-days, how they're feeling about certain things. And I'll be honest, when I taught high school, there were days that we didn't get anything done in health class. And that's okay, because you're developing that community to help people heal. And part of that also has to deal with the teacher and how they're processing their baggage and how they're processing their trauma. Because if you're working with kids with trauma, and especially in an environment of high precarity, you're going to have baggage, you're going to have trauma yourself. So if you're not mimicking those processes and how to handle that and how to work with that, like we've already said multiple times, like being that rock, it doesn't work. Like I've seen so many different classrooms where you can tell the relationship isn't there. It's a very traditional top-down authoritarian perspective. Like you see kids really aren't learning. They're not developing a love for the process of learning. School develops bad community. So like I'll say it again, it's been nice to read like the section that I have been able to, and about how there are so many truths to it. And like I said, it's kind of cool to know that you're doing the right things.
So what I've got, especially from when you summarized, Dash, was, wouldn't there be a danger if we didn't raise a bar for everybody when we were doing these sort of things? Because if you were to raise a bar for just the child, raise a bar, maybe not the right term, but to focus on those five particular points, would there not be a danger to do that just for that one child? Because then they would be more likely to feel almost singled out and like that they've done something wrong. Whereas it might be, would it not be more beneficial to, as some others have said, raise it for everybody? That way they don't feel as singled out. But again, that it could just be it's got to be treated sort of like case by case almost.
I'm gonna answer that really quickly from why I said it, and then leave it to everybody else. But in raising the bar, I don't think you have to identify anyone. You just need to raise your game when you're dealing with those. So it's the way that you understand them. You understand where they're coming from. You understand what you're doing for them specifically. So if you take the lesson plan that we have, you know, we particularly picking out individuals who have special educational needs. Well, you know, these are individuals who have particular educational needs. So, you know, thinking about how you can deal with them is not flagging it up to the whole class, but it's thinking of, so you're conscious of who these individuals are and you're raising the bar to make sure you can support them. And that's what I mean by this. But there's two things. I'm aware of time. I've got about maybe 7 minutes left. So let's finish at 10:02. Let's open it up to everybody else. Please come back to me, you know, on that. You know, maybe we should be raising the bar to everybody. I'm particularly interested in Ollie and Rachel's, you know, point of view on that one. But equally, let's try and sort of summarize thoughts in the next.
Yeah, well, I think that's a really interesting question, Cameron. I think that there is, it is important to sort of recognize that. I think for any young person, you know, that inclusion is about meeting children's needs, and children have different needs regardless of kind of what population they fall into, if you like. And one of the things that came out of our Right to Be Active work, which led into this, was that you talk to young people sometimes and they were in this sort of difficult situation. They saw this, there was a tension. They wanted people to know their context, their circumstances, so that it could be addressed, but they didn't want to stand out. They didn't want it to be flagged, you know, for the world to see. So there is that tension there. I think they want to recognize that actually, you know, my life is quite difficult, but I want you to fix it without making a deal of it. So I think there is a challenge there in that sense. So there is a sense that if you you put some of these principles into practice for everybody and it meets the needs of people as and when they deal with them. But I see Ash's point as well, that, you know, sometimes having that a little bit additional knowledge allows you to make sure that you do meet the needs where young people have needs that are beyond those of others. So, but it's a difficult one. There's no easy answer to it. So I think it's an important question to ask.
Yeah, and I think it comes back to that sort of equality, equity debate, you know, sometimes recognising that to help everyone be equal, sometimes some people need a little bit more. But I think Rachel's point is one that I would emphasise, that, you know, in talking to children in care and recognising they're just sort of one youth population and the one that we've worked with specifically to sort of underpin some of this work, that they sit in this sort of awkward position in between sort of knowing that their experiences are different and their needs might be different to some of their peers, and that actually that might have implications for their engagement in lessons, for their learning, etc. But equally, they don't want to be othered or outed necessarily as being care experienced. So they tread a really difficult line sometimes. It's almost like when they're telling you what they need, it's that, okay, well, we maybe do need some things configured differently because of our experiences, but we don't want to be different to the others. So it's a really, really interesting point you raised there, Cameron.
I just have a question for Ollie and Rachel, if that's okay. I just from your perspective, do you think we need to perhaps redesign the way, or some part of the way we're doing teacher training, so you teachers are more aware, or are more skilled to cope, or understand how to deal with children that have experienced trauma?
I think it would be really valuable. Because not necessarily because there aren't aspects of good practice. Like we've said, there are lots of, pedagogical approaches that talk to this. You know, good pedagogy is about building relationships and understanding. It's about care. It's about all of these things. But I think there are at times areas where we just need a little bit more context-specific information about some of this. And as Ollie said, we've been working with care experienced young people. They have a very different experience to perhaps some of their peers, and they may have similar kind of traumatic experiences, if you like, but the context in which they live is very different. So I think it is valuable in to have this trauma-aware, trauma-informed approach. But equally, I would argue that, in the UK particularly, it's important to know how things like the care system works, what the role of education is, you know, what the role of teachers are, you know, because there's a real mismatch there. And actually, one of the next papers that is currently under production, I think that's on my desk, is asking that question of whose responsibility is all of this. And ultimately, I think we have to come to the conclusion that we all need to take some responsibility. And so actually having some of that embedded in teacher education might be quite valuable. I don't know whether Ollie would add to any of that.
Yeah, I completely agree that, I mean, we're obviously advocates for this. We'd love to see this filter into those teacher training programs. But equally, we recognise how packed they are already and how much we expect teachers to do on those teacher training programs. So recognising that, you know, as much as might be useful to have it on there, if not, I guess asking questions around what scope there is for professional development activities in that space.
That's a good point that Rachel and Ollie bring up, that I wonder, does it beg the question if it's everyone's responsibility? What I'm assuming is that from a school context or from an educator context, the question that I wonder is, physical education uniquely positioned to address trauma with children in K-12 settings? Is this an opportunity for us to again to set us apart?
I guess to respond to that, I think that there are huge benefits to kind of looking at the potential that physical education has on the curriculum to be able to bring benefits for young people across different domains, and to be able to give them different kinds of experiences. And the sort of structure of physical education as being slightly different on the curriculum is helpful. And again, just as an example, one of the young people we spoke to said that, you know, they get kicked out of lessons. Where do they go? They go to the PE block. They guarantee somebody's there and they can talk to somebody. They can offload. They can have that conversation. And so that I think it it can fulfill that role. Other places could too, but I think that we could own that potential. You know, we could say, look, that we can give something special here, we can help. And I think that that is something that we could look to do.
I'm just aware of time. We could go on and on in a really good way. I know Steve's teaching in about 12 minutes, so you know, I've got to be aware of the individuals he's going to be working with. Barry, to answer the question, I've already, my take home for this is I've already approached Rachel and Ollie to do a session on the PGCE course in the summer. Estelle, we need to rework the timetable, so I'll throw that one on your desk. I do think it's really important. I mean, we found out last week that the PGC students know nothing about physical literacy. They know nothing about trauma-aware pedagogies. There is a huge amount to try to fit into a teacher education course, and that's why we talk about lifelong learning. And I think it's really important that these sorts of discussions occur. And it just leaves to me to say a huge thank you to everybody for being here. Thank you to Ollie and Rachel, and please pass on our best to Tom, who I know is child caring at the moment. Thanks to everybody for being here. You're more than welcome any week or every week you wish to. Estelle, you cannot say that again, but you can't say it's the only time you've ever been. So thank you much. Thanks very much, everybody. And once again, thanks to the authors for such a great paper.
And that's where our discussions ended. I'd like to thank Barry, Cameron, Dan and Steve for their insights as pre-service and in-service teachers. Estelle, Michelle, Alex, Clancy and Risto as teacher educators, and Rachel and Ollie as authors for lending their thoughts to our discussion. Thanks for listening, stay safe, and hopefully you'll choose to catch up with us next time when we talk about geography, dehumanisation and seeking spatial justice in kinesiology.